and you are listening to EcoJustice Radio from the KPFK Los Angeles studio. A project of SoCal 350 Climate Action, our show presents environmental and climate stories from a social justice frame, featuring voices not necessarily heard on traditional, mainstream, or even public media outlets. I am your host, Jessica Aldridge from Adventures in Waste, and you are listening to part 5 of a special 7-part series called The Plastic Plague, connecting the dots between extraction, inequity, and pollution. In today's 5th installment, we break down the bottle scam, land, water, and indigenous rights. Today's guest speakers are Steve Wilson, co-director of Peak Plastic Foundation and creator and producer of the film The Story of Plastic, and Raven Stevens, a board member of WATER. We advocate thorough environmental review and a community liaison of the Gateway Neighborhood Association. Steve Wilson is an award-winning activist, filmmaker, and educator working on the nexus of marine conservation, plastic pollution, petrochemical production, and human rights. After completing 35,000 nautical miles sailing the world to study marine plastic pollution, Steve co-authored the first ever global estimate of the abundance of plastics in all major 5 oceans in the peer-reviewed journal Plus One. Steve is the co-founder of Break Free from Plastic and the creator and producer of the film The Story of Plastic. Raven Stevens is a water protector and community advocate living in Mount Shasta, California. She is working with WATER, We Advocate Thorough Environmental Review, and the local community to stop industrial water extraction in and around Mount Shasta. She plans to keep up the fight to prevent Crystal Geyser from harming the mountain and all life downstream. Over the past 4 episodes, we have covered extraction, refinement, human health impacts of plastic, and the effects of a throwaway society. In each episode, we connect the environmental impacts and social inequity and provide the solutions we must look to as a means of reducing the plastic plague. Be sure to subscribe to EcoJustice Radio and tune in to each installment of the series. On today's episode, we will connect the dots between the water bottle scam and the fight for land, water, and indigenous rights. Support of zero waste isn't as easy as switching over to a reusable water bottle. The solutions we enact and wish others to do the same must be accessible and equitable to all. When this fails to happen, it is our duty to stand in allyship, zero waste allyship, and support solutions. Water is the most basic human need. Water is sacred. Water is life. Without water, our bodies and environment would cease to live. No one should go without. Clean, reliable, and free water should be available to all. But when our water sources are depleted and polluted, access is limited. Companies are swift to sell us back solutions and increase our dependency on them to provide something that was once free, but now costs 2,000 times more. These bottles they are selling to us contain much more than water and flavored beverages. The chain of environmental and social impacts is an embedded cost of bottled water, a resource that is supposed to give us life, but now arguably the process to extract, make, ship, store, and dispose seems to take from it. When cities go without because their water infrastructure falters, our dependency on plastic and overpriced bottles of hope seem to be the only solution provided. Investments in clean tap water for all is not coming from the sources so quick to close the tap and monetize a human right. But is that a surprise when a Pepsi representative has been quoted saying, "The biggest enemy is tap water"? With a 500 million bottles used and disposed every week in the United States and a failing water infrastructure system, it is time to close the tap on the bottle scam. Thank you for tuning in to installment 5, The Bottle Scam, Land, Water, and Indigenous Rights of our Plastic Plague 7-part series. At the time of this recording, we are all practicing social distancing and calling in from our respective homes. Unfortunately, we are not in our normal KPFK Los Angeles studios, so please bear with us on any sound quality issues. It is my honor to welcome to the show our special guest, Steve Wilson, co-director of Peak Plastic Foundation and creator and producer of the film, The Story of Plastic, and Raven Stevens, board member of Water. We advocate thorough environmental review. Welcome to the show. Steve, you are the creator and executive producer of the movie Story of Plastic and have started a nonprofit called the Peak Plastic Foundation. What is the mission and purpose of this organization and why did you start it?
Especially in a pandemic? Well, Peak Plastic Foundation is just a few weeks old, and our mission is really to continue the intersectional storytelling that we did when we made Story of Plastic. When we traveled around the world looking at, you know, the lived experience of people along the supply chain from extraction to disposal, we recognized how the power of storytelling and bringing global north people to the global south and bringing global south people to the global north and all collaborating to tell a story, like, it really has a tremendous impact. I think our film is an example of that. And ultimately, it's less for us at Peak Plastic Foundation about just telling a story. It's about weaponizing a narrative and working with an intersectional group of folks to really get at what is happening on the ground. I'm excited to be here with Raven because we'd love to work up in the Shasta County as well, or Siskiyou County is where I think it is actually. You know, to tell that story from all the perspectives of people affected. And that's really what we're here to do.
And Raven, what is the mission of Water and what is your role with them?
Well, Water came about as a response to yet another attempt to bottle water in the Mount Shasta area. Water's mission is to advocate the preservation of natural resources and a healthy environment. We attempt to advocate for long-range community planning and regenerative practices that protect all citizens and to promote a thriving economy and community. We don't like, you know, less than living wage jobs. We want to communicate these concerns to local government officials and agencies. We work to encourage community-wide participation through educating the public about the issues. And lastly, we defend these issues with public interest litigation activities when and if necessary. And I am a board member because I do all of the above, plus I monitor groundwater levels in the domestic wells surrounding the plant to try to protect the local community members.
And before we jump into this, let's set up the picture here. Steve, briefly walk us through the abbreviated version of the life cycle of a water bottle.
Well, essentially, all plastics come from fossil fuels, and increasingly, the United States is one of the biggest producers of petrochemicals to serve as feedstocks for plastics. And so a water bottle is made out of number one plastics. If you look underneath it, it will have a number one code on it, and it says PET, and that stands for polyethylene terephthalate. So essentially, we do fracking all throughout the Ohio River Valley, Texas, North Dakota, the West in general. And these feedstocks are what we make bottles out of. A lot of impacted communities on the extraction side of the fossil fuels coming out of the ground, both from emissions, respiratory illnesses, cancer, leukemia specifically. Basically, plastic is starting to pollute the second it comes out of the ground. Then, water bottle company will place an order for pellets, and these little plastic pellets will be melted into the shape of a bottle, and then that water company also has to have a source for that water. In many cases, it's tap water, but the sort of spring water is coming from sources like where Raven lives as well, and they're looking for pure sources of water and looking to privatize, put that into bottles. And then, you know, sort of preying on the consumer's increasing desire for sanitation and freshness in a crazy world, they consume that water and then they place it in the recycle bin. That recycle, depending on where you are in the United States, that will either go to recycling plant domestically, or it will be exported. And that won't be going to China anymore. China has refused this. It's increasingly going to Southeast Asia, Western Central America, Africa. And there it is mainly turned into textiles, or it is straight burned for fuel. Because the cost of recycling plastic is more than virgin material, we're seeing a sort of inverse incentive amongst exports, which means that where we used to get paid as a waste hauler to take PET plastics, we're now having to pay to get rid of them. Not in every case, but certainly in some cases, and I can't underscore enough, every jurisdiction is different. But in the vast majority of cases, that plastic is now becoming a burden in a foreign country. And before, when we were getting paid for it, whoever was buying it had to turn it into a product and make a profit. Now that we're paying to offload it, that is giving sort of an unscrupulous motivation in the market, where if you are in a receiving country where you've paid off officials and can just receive it and burn it, you're going to do that. And so the recycling infrastructure as a whole, the largest problem is that the supply of waste plastics far outpaces demand. And so in a nutshell, comes out of the ground, you buy it, you put it down a rabbit hole, and somebody's life is affected on the other side as well.
You touched upon those major effects that are happening on the downstream as well. When we look at the impact of a water bottle, are these companies taking the full climate impacts into consideration that happen on the upstream as well? And what are those, like transportation and things of that nature?
We're not. I mean, both from the perspective of capturing all the climate implications of the life cycle of a plastic bottle, both from a federal policy standpoint, that all the emissions with the extraction of fossil fuels, the transporting of fossil fuels, the emissions associated with construction of refineries and et cetera, the refineries themselves, none of those emissions are actually recorded in any life cycle analysis of the quote unquote greenness of the plastic bottle. So they're getting a major carbon pass when being compared to other materials immediately. And then after you consume it, you buy it in a convenience store in a regular refrigerated cabinet. Well, for example, Nestle has a brand called Arrowhead, which comes from a disputed water right in the San Bernardino National Forest in Southern California. Sort of the Inland Empire is what they call it in Southern California. And, you know, those residents are facing very similar situations to the fight up at Mount Shasta. And, you know, they're getting no economic benefit. But beyond that, when you buy this bottle on the West Coast, if you're drinking the Arrowhead brand in Seattle, that was trucked all the way from Southern California, 1,000-plus miles, probably 1,300 miles, in a semi-truck, and those emissions are not being calculated. And then whatever the refrigeration is at the 7-Eleven, that's not being calculated. And then the waste hauling after you put that in the recycle bin, that's not being calculated. And then the ship, it's traveling on to whatever market is taking it, it's not being calculated. And then if it's burned, it's not being calculated. So when anybody talks about plastic being a better choice for climate change, it is actually synonymous with climate change.
Div, you just mentioned San Bernardino, the campaigns that you've worked on there. There's Cascade Locks in Oregon. There's things that have happened in Maine and Pennsylvania that are also fighting against Nestle and the Arrowhead water bottle brand. What are the social impacts that you've seen in those areas?
So, you know, these big multinational water brands come into a community and they say, hey, we're going to give you a really sweet deal because the cleaner the water, the more rural the geography typically. I hate to say it, but the closer humans are to a pristine water source, chances are it's going to be more contaminated, unless there's some sort of geological reason for contamination. So you're talking about predation on small towns that don't have a huge tax base, may have depressed industries, may have been victim of a boom and bust, whether it's timber or, you know, some other sort of agricultural or extractive process. And they sort of wine and dine city council members and say, hey, we're going to bring jobs and we're going to bring prosperity to your town. And all we need is tax subsidizations to come in. And that means we don't have to pay for the trucks driving on the roads that you can barely afford to upkeep as it is. It's a profound win for a big bottled water company, and it's a profound loss for a small community where that water is taken. They may get a few bucks and they might build a few playgrounds or a school, but they're not going to stick around. And, you know, frankly, bottled water is a pretty automated process. It's not creating well-paying, sustainable jobs in these places. And if it is, it's, you know, a dozen or less in most cases. So beyond that, it tends to divide a town on we need growth and prosperity versus no, we need to protect our homeland. And that's actually like a false conflict to begin with, because the truth of the matter is the bottled water company is making the money off of this. The town is getting the short end of the stick.
And in some places, when they cut the tap, when they come in and take over, especially in global communities, they come over and privatize that water, they take over, they literally are cutting off the tap to those communities downstream, and they no longer have access to water. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at Flint, Michigan, which is still suffering profoundly with the inability for the citizenry there to access clean water. And that was a really bad deal that was done by the state of Michigan to give access to Nestle to get a better source of water and cut the clean water out of the public good and give the dirty water that's going to cause the erosion in the pipes that is going to create the lead that is coming off, because there's the two sources of water. One was very, very clean, and the other was contaminated to some degree with a chemical that would react to, you know, undermine the infrastructure.
If you are just tuning in, you are listening to EcoJustice Radio on KPFK Los Angeles. We are here with Steve Wilson, co-director of Peak Plastic Foundation and the creator and producer of the film The Story of Plastic, and Raven Stevens, board member of Water, We Advocate Thorough Environmental Review, discussing The Bottle Scam, Land, Water, and Indigenous Rights, which is part 5 of our 7-part series on the plastic plague.
Steve, so we've been talking about the land and water issues that come with bottled water companies, what's happening here in the United States and a little bit globally. How did we get here? I mean, bottling of water and selling it back to us is a relatively new consumer product, and it, in my opinion, a marketing ploy. And tap water is usually cleaner, cheaper, and held to a higher standard. And a lot of time, these bottle companies are using tap water and then selling it back to us, right? So how did we get here?
In a post-pandemic world, I'm going to like reframe my answer to this. But it's all about manufacturing demand and manufacturing a false hope. And this is what the bottled water industry did so masterfully. What they did is they became the merchants of doubt. What they did to make you think bottled water was the cleaner, healthier, more refreshing, made you look better, a status symbol, was to start questioning whether public water was safe. That is, tap water was safe. Even though they knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that tap water was safe in the vast majority of every place that it serves in the United States. It's infinitesimal how many systems are actually compromised when water is a public utility. But they convince you that it's pedestrian or it's uncool or it's a little dirty. And if you're drinking this, you're going to have the experience. If you're drinking the product, you're going to have the experience of standing at the top of a mountain while the moon is rising and the sun is setting at the same time. And we, being emotional creatures who are navigating our lives, having to pick up our kids, to plan dinner, to work amidst all the chaos. And we're looking for any piece of solace or levity that we can find. And so that is exactly where marketing comes in. It promises you something better. It promises you a better life. And it doesn't take into account the unforeseen consequences of when you shift a public perception of something as basic as water, as something as important as water. That has business implications so vast that if you get the public generally thinking the water is dirty, the entire infrastructure and delivery system has to change. And, oh, by the way, it becomes privatized and profitized. And the scary thing about going down that road, my opinion, whether you're left or right, is if you don't have access to clean water, if you can't afford clean water, as they say, water is life, and they're right.
And Raven, you are, you live or standing on top of that proverbial mountain that Steve just mentioned, and those unforeseen consequences are happening currently in Mount Shasta, given water bottling plants that are in that area. Historically, what has been happening in Mount Shasta and the surrounding areas because of these water bottle companies?
Okay, yeah, I just want to say Steve really hit the nail on the head when he talks about how companies come in and wine and dine city council members and things, and it just opens the doorway to these promises of jobs and things that never actually appear. So Mount Shasta, as you know, is quite a large mountain by volume. There are many communities that surround it. Currently, one of the plants that's open is called Crystal Geyser Roxanne, and it's in Weed, California, 6 miles just north of us on the mountain, and it extracts unlimited amounts of water from the northwest side of the Mount Shasta. They've been operating since the mid-1900s, and they have expanded their bottling plant 3 times in the past 25 years. If you're keeping a scorecard about what products not to buy, I want to tell you that their products are named Crystal Geyser Roxanne Bottled Water, Roxanne Mountain Water, and they also bottled water for Trader Joe's. So what we're asking you to do is keep track of these and not purchase them, because we estimate that they truck millions of gallons per week packed in those single-use plastic bottles, and they sell them in the United States and in Japan. So if we tie that back, what's the carbon footprint of shipping bottled water from California to Japan? It's unbelievable. This area, if some of you have been up here, it's renowned for its magnificent vistas and very fragile ecosystems. They have a business that extracts unlimited amounts of groundwater, and we know that it's going to be environmentally damaging to our shared aquifer and also to the waters of the Sacramento River, which is our major water source for all of California. And these natural waters that flow from here are significant to the Winnemem-Wintu tribe, to their culture, and in their cultural territory.
How many water bottle companies are in Mount Shasta and the surrounding area of that mountain? And I guess how many are actually in California as well?
Right. In this area, we have 2 plants that are open. That's Crystal Geyser Roxanne and Castle Castle Rock Water Bottling Company in Dunsmuir, which is just 6 miles below us. Plants are proposing to open a group of 20 developers from the San Francisco Bay Area that are attempting to open a they're attempting to get permits and developers agreements to open water bottling in McLeod, California, which is on the south side of Mount Shasta. What we believe they're attempting to do is get all the permits and all their T's crossed and I's dotted and all set in place, and then we think they're going to sell it to a major bottler like Nestle, who we fought off out of the McLeod area just about 8 years ago, or they'll sell it to Crystal Geyser. So we know that we have to be vigilant and continue to push out these attempts to take the public's water.
You had said that Crystal Geyser was a Japanese company, correct? Who owns that?
Yeah, Crystal Geyser Water Company is owned by Otsuka Pharmaceutical in Japan. They're a foreign national corporation. Yep, a foreign national corporation that is taking the water that belongs to Californians, and they're shipping it to Japan and reselling it back to people in the United States.
You had mentioned the Winnemem-Wintu tribe. We've had Chief Colleen on the show in the past here on EcoJustice Radio. The Winnemem-Wintu tribe is one indigenous tribe in that area. There are a handful, correct? What are the tribes in that area?
Yeah, along with the Winnemem-Wintu tribe, there's the Pitt River tribe, the Modoc, and the Klamath tribes, and they all surround the mountain.
And you, with water, have a relationship with the Winnemem-Wintu. What has that partnership been?
Well, I can't speak for the tribe, but in these past 7 years, I've learned a lot from them. What I've witnessed is that the tribe has an intimate relationship with the water here. The relationship is so deep that they consider water a relative. Just like you have relatives in your family, water is a relative for them. They know water. They sing to water. They pray with water. So it's really a true relationship. We are, our group, Water, or We Advocate Thorough Environmental Review, we're allies with the tribe in the best sense of the word. Our group has learned so much from them. Chief Sisk is very active and vocal, and anytime we share space with them, we learn new ways of seeing the world. And our role is to rally the community, to provide science and evidence of the wrongful practice of water bottling, and to support the tribe in any way that is asked of us. Together, we filed the original lawsuits against Siskiyou County and the city of Mount Shasta, and the party of interest, which is Crystal Geyser Water Company.
And Crystal Geyser, you were on a call that we had had before this. You had told me that Crystal Geyser is calling this their spring, like Crystal Geyser Spring. And they also made a commercial that referenced the indigenous tribes in that area. I think I know the answer to this, but I will ask it. Was there approval by the indigenous tribes? Is it Crystal Geyser's spring? And was there any compensation to the tribes for using their image?
Yeah. You can only imagine how this goes down. It's purely a PR tactic. They want to make the water that they're selling to people seem better than your tap water at home, so that you'll spend your hard-earned money on their products. They don't pay a penny to the county for that water, and they never, not once, asked to speak with the tribe or the chief about what they plan to do here. They're simply using them for their own profit scheme. What they're doing is they're selling the sacredness of the water. And if they really believed it was sacred, they would never bottle it in the first place. I feel like it's disgusting, and why you really should not spend your money on it. I want you all to think about the fact that you vote yes every time you purchase it. And there are human beings, communities, small towns, and tribes at the back end of that yes vote. And water is being harmed as well. And one of the things I think that's really important that Chief Sisk always says, why would you take ice cold clean water off the side of a volcano when the volcano is dormant. Why would you take that cooling aspect off of the mountain? What kind of harm is that going to do? So that's another, just another thing to think about.
Thank you for that. And there's the effect. There's the effect to the indigenous tribes. There's the effect to the water. What are the homeowners in that area experiencing from this unlimited and unregulated pumping of water in their community?
Right. Well, in 2001, Dannon Bottling Company opened a plant. And in 2005, Coca-Cola bought a portion of it, so it was Coca-Cola Dannon. So from 2001 to 2010, this neighborhood experienced the loss of access of their water from their domestic wells. And if it wasn't outright loss of water, it was they experienced poor water quality, which ruined water tanks, dishwashers. And we had people that had to buy 5-gallon bottles of water to live on at their house because they could not use their well. Now, that plant shuttered its doors in 2010. So they stopped pumping. That was in November of 2010. By that winter, people's wells cleared. They had access to their water. And then from 2010 to now, the plant is still not open. But we went through a 5-year drought from 2011 to 2016. Those people, even in the extreme drought that California was in, they still had good quality water to use that whole time. And what was the difference? No industrial water extraction. So the difference is this, you know, they've got a bigger straw and they're taking a lot more water than the small homes.
And as Steph had mentioned before too, they have excess amounts of diesel truck traffic, and you know, to transport all this stuff, and the air pollution from these things as well, and then eventually the waste production that comes from having to bottle all of this material, and that's a direct impact on the community as well. How much water do these plants pump in a day, and where is it being? We had talked about where it's being sold. So how much water are they pumping in a day?
Well, let's just take what they have said to be their maximum extraction amount. And I'll tell you something, that maximum amount is just something on paper. They are not held to that. There's no monitoring of that. And there's no way to hold them to that number. But the number that they gave us was 365,000 gallons a day when they're at full operation. So that's their maximum pumping. Okay? So they're going to pump 365,000 gallons of water a day. That equates, and this is a different number than you and I originally talked about, because this is their maximum volume, but this equates to 12 of my neighbors using their water for an entire year. 12 neighbors using their water for an entire year will equate to one day of pumping for Crystal Geyser Water Company.
That is depressing and angering. Steve, are you seeing the same story globally and in the United States where you've experienced these same issues?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Raven said at the beginning of the question that I had nailed it on the head, and, you know, about how water bottle companies behave in these communities. And it's sort of at this point, it's like, it's the playbook. We've all seen it. Anybody who's working on this issue has seen these sort of unscrupulous tactics. And especially, you know, in the United States in particular, the impact on indigenous communities is one that, you know, really speaks to my heart. Because when you think of indigenous communities in the United States, they're the least populous, they're the least politically powerful, they've been marginalized ever since the inception of this country and before, frankly. And you have you have these tribal elders who are working in a modern world and educated in a modern world to preserve, you know, some shred of heritage and tradition and beauty. And a company like Crystal Geyser comes in and markets that sacred beauty, that sacred connection. And to me, that is the ugliest thing in the world. That is making water a prostitute that is being pimped out by a company. And the impact on those communities to have everything stolen can still be resilient in the face of that, to still hold on to tradition, to still, you know, build their languages into their curriculum and carry on their oral traditions. And it's like we're destroying the very fabric of the thing we want, which is an authentic experience in harmony with the earth, and we're commodifying it and destroying it. And that is played out over and over and over all throughout the United States. And it's despicable.
If you are just tuning in, you are listening to EcoJustice Radio on KPFK Los Angeles. We are here with Steve Wilson, co-director of Peak Plastic Foundation and the creator and producer of the film The Story of Plastic, and Raven Stevens, board member of Water, We Advocate Thorough Environmental Review, discussing the bottle scam, land, water, and indigenous rights, which is part 5 of our 7-part series on the plastic plague.
Raven, there was one thing I wanted to touch upon with you. What happens if a homeowner has to dig a deeper well in order to be able to get the water that is owed to them, their own water?
Right. Well, up here we have what's called a volcanic aquifer. So the water is in cracked, fractured rock, lava tubes. It's not just sitting in a kind of a basin like a big bowl that you just, you know, put your straw in and drink. So wells can be dug, and you may or may not hit water. You may have had water, you've lost it from the bottling company, and you think, oh, well, all you have to do is, you know, I'll just have to go and dig a deeper well, but I'll still find water. Well, that may or may not be true. But what I want to let you guys know is that if a homeowner has to just turn around and dig a deeper well, wells cost about $100 a foot. And the last well that I know of that had to be installed because of Coca-Cola Dannon lowering the aquifer, that well had to be dug to 260 feet. That's $26,000. And I don't know anybody in my circle of friends that has that type of money in savings. It's dramatic. What happens if they don't have that money? These folks, I won't name their names, but they went to the county and asked for help. The county said, sorry, not our problem. Call the company. They called the company. The company said, we don't have anything to do with that. You're just going to have to dig a deeper well. So the person had nowhere else to go. So what did they do? They just cut their losses. They called a well driller. They got a loan, and they had to dig a deeper well. So, you know, the company's making hand over fist profits, and the neighbors have nothing. They have no recourse right now.
Aren't there groundwater laws in place in all 50 states, especially here in California? Wouldn't these regulations protect the groundwater and the land rights of the people who are living on this land?
Well, one would think so, but we have 50 states in the United States, and California has some of the worst water law on the books. The worst one is Texas. That's at number 50. California, nice green California, is number 49 in water law. They've tried to fix that by having the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, or SGMA. And that act is attempting to define and protect groundwater basins from overdraft throughout California. You see, the groundwater is being pumped so heavy that in the Central Valley, the ground is experiencing what they call subsidence, which means that the actual ground is sinking. SGMA is an attempt to stop overpumping of the groundwater. Now, Mount Shasta, you think, okay, well, great. So that new law will protect, you know, small towns from water bottling companies, from overpumping. But Mount Shasta got removed. We had a groundwater basin here, but the Department of Water Resources removed our basin and just called us a volcanic aquifer. So we have no protections. And basically what I think most people don't understand but need to know is that all the water that comes from the mountain areas, like the Siskiyou Cascade Range up here or the entire Sierra Nevada Range, are volcanic aquifers. They're the state's water recharge system. And they are not protected from overdraft or industrial water extraction. So you can imagine that these bottling companies, and yes, Jessica, there are 109 bottling companies in California alone. 109. So some of these bottling companies are down in the groundwater basins that are going to be controlled by SGMA. And they are wanting to leave the areas that are going to be under regulation, because they don't want anybody telling them how much they can pump, when they can pump, what to do if there's damages to other people. They want to go to a place where there's no rules to protect communities or California water. So they're coming up to the water recharge areas. And that's something everybody really needs to be aware of.
Steve, you had mentioned previously, we were talking about Flint, Michigan. Now you brought up Flint. We have, you know, they're not able to drink their own water. They have issues with Nestle that you had mentioned as well. We have other places here in Southern California, like Willowbrook, California, which we've covered on a previous show on Ecojustice Radio, that also, because of privatization issues and water toxicity issues, they're not able to drink their own water either. Has there been any change in Flint, Michigan to clean, safe, affordable water, Detroit and Flint, and any further connection to Nestle that you want to mention?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, Raven mentioned how crazy it was that water being extracted in California is going to a Japanese market and traveling by ship, water literally traveling by water across, you know, the biggest ocean in the world. In Michigan, Nestle, for one of their spring water brands, is Ice Mountain, is extracting it 121 miles away from Flint. And give or take, but I think that number is right, it's definitely not more than, you know, 150 miles. But ultimately, you have the interest of this multinational corporation literally doing exactly what Raven's talking about, taking the water from a local population and transporting it to give relief when the public water system fails in Flint. Like, it's crazy to me. Nestle was big on the, we're bringing bottled water in and we're giving water away. And they did this PR campaign. And the irony of that, where residents were not getting the information they needed to know, how does our water system get fixed so I can not shampoo my hair with bottled water? That wasn't being answered. And all the news and the media and the PR was, you know, these big bottled water companies coming in to save the day, which is, it's crazy. But you know, we're in a time in our lives where crazy is every day, and it's not serving us, and it's definitely not serving the people of Flint, Michigan, to have Nestle with a massive operation on the other side of the state.
And they're co-opting this idea. It's like, well, we care about you. We care. We're going to give you water. But if they really did care, then they would be investing in the health of the community, not by bottled water, but by upgrading their infrastructure and ensuring that they have access to clean water. Raven, water is involved in a lawsuit now in appellate court against the Siskiyou County and Mount Shasta City, with Crystal Geyser being the real party of interest here. What is the court case about, and what is water asking for?
Well, we and the tribe are co-plaintiffs in this court case. We have a list of deficiencies that were in the environmental impact report, which is a report that Siskiyou County and with the help of Crystal Geyser, well, they actually, Crystal Geyser actually wrote the thing, talked about what are the impacts that are going to be on the community, on water, the whole bit. That environmental impact report was approved by the county, and we then sued the county, and we lost in court. The court found on every aspect of against us on every aspect that we brought forward. We were not surprised by that because we live in Siskiyou County and we understand what the politics are here, what the mindset here is. This county has never met a resource that they didn't want to extract. Now, the interesting thing is that this resource that the company is extracting and making money on, Siskiyou County is not making a dime on it. Not a dime. They're not charging them per gallon or anything. The only thing they're making is property taxes, which if that land were used for homes, they'd be getting property taxes from homeowners rather than the corporation. But the county itself's not making any money. So when they when we appealed, we're appealing on six major issues. There's a lot, but I'll tell you the six. It's unlimited water extraction with no actual pumping limits and no protections for the neighboring domestic wells if they go dry or have water quality issues. There's a huge air pollution impact, which you know, my focus is on water, but that air pollution impact is just as bad as the water impact. It would literally, according to our estimates, we hired consultants for this, it would make this area a cancer hotspot. So we'd be seeing more cancer cases in the next coming 20 years or so. Also, the county violated law AB 52, which is a law that was enacted for the California Environmental Quality Act. And it's to basically consult with local tribes, and they're required to consult to find out what the impacts are on their traditional cultural resources. And so the county did not complete the required consultation, and they did not take the Winnemem and Wintu tribes' cultural and sacred values into account at all. They stopped the consultation early because it did not fit into the timeline that they had to open the plant. Now, the ironic thing is that was like 3 years ago, and we're still in court with them, so they really could have done the full consultation if they had wanted to. There are no severe noise and vibration concerns for neighboring homes. There's people, when the other plant was in operation, people couldn't sleep at night. They couldn't have their windows open in the summer for fresh air to come in because of the noise. Like Steve had mentioned, there's severe traffic impacts on the streets. The streets were not designed for, 100 truck trips a day, and there's no compensation going to the city for any kind of street repairs. And also the city of Mount Shasta, who agreed to have a wastewater treatment hookup with Crystal Geyser, they gave them a permit. They can't even handle Crystal Geyser's effluent, because their own wastewater treatment plant is antiquated, and allowing the hookup risks more pollution violations at the state level, which causes taxpayers' money and pollutes at the headwaters of the Sacramento River. So all of that caused us to have to go forward in the appellate court because they approved the facility, and they're not really requiring Crystal Geyser to be accountable. Siskiyou County and Mount Shasta are set to give away corporate subsidies worth mega millions of dollars and exposing neighbors and possibly the city itself to pollution, groundwater depletion, and facilitating the damage and destruction of tribal cultural resources that are sacred to the Winnemem and Wintu tribe. So that's why through that system, we're asking for and committed to protecting water and our community and the environment for future generations.
Steve, for these communities that are dealing with the offenses of the water bottle companies, what are some of the tactics that the communities can implement to push back? And in addition to that, I want to talk about solutions that, you know, bottled water is, it's tangible. We can see it. We can feel it. But all of these other issues that we've been talking about are, they're not tangible. We don't see them per se. We don't see them. How do we drive a collective seriousness towards activism to push back on what's happening in these communities and to push back on the effects that our everyday products are having?
Well, my first advice is be like Raven. Be somebody who cares about your community and is willing to take civic action, because there's a snowball effect when you do it. It's a thankless job, but it's actually one that creates a democratic and resilient community. So be like Raven, first of all. Quit asking about what I can do from my individual buying habits and what can I actually affect in my community. Once you get to the community level, there's a suite of policies that can be enacted actually and beat the lawyers from a, you know, $100 billion corporation. And that's basically saying, hey, we're going to pass an ordinance that says there's a very small limit that you can take from our water source. A very small limit. And that'll allow you to have breweries, that'll allow you to have other things that are, you know, build up community resiliency. And certainly there's many other businesses than breweries, but a good brewery is a good thing in a little town. It's a community gathering spot. And ultimately, you can pass an ordinance like this. Case in point was Cascade Locks in Oregon. And Nestle came in, wanted to put in a $50 billion bottling plant. And the citizens of Hood River, who all had day jobs, had, you know, a depressed economy in a lot of ways, said, hey, no, this is not good for us. And about six women and one indigenous leader there pushed back and said, we're going to pass this at a ballot measure. And state of Washington essentially just did this as well. They just said, no new permits for water extraction. Like, we can't afford this as a state. And so I think more and more you're going to see these kind of policies at the state and local level. And if you really want to make a difference, yeah, don't drink bottled water, but get involved. Be like Raven.
And Raven, definitely be like Raven. Water has been working on some solutions directly in Mount Shasta. They're looking at water bottle refill and drinking stations, looking at reducing plastic in local stores. What does elaborate on these? What do solutions look like to you?
Yeah, well, thank you for the Be Like Raven thing, but listen, I'm a spokesperson for many, many people here, and we're all working together to do this. But yeah, get active in your local community. I think that's a beautiful thing. We, you know, even though we are involved in a lawsuit with the city of Mount Shasta, we're actually working with them to build a water refill station here so that people can refill their water bottles. We're working with the Mountain Runners Association and the Downtown Beautification Association to install that permanent water refill station downtown. We think it's going to be in place by July of this year. I'm not sure. Due to the COVID-19 thing, we're going to have a big 4th of July run this year, but we're going to have a refill station at all costs. We're doing that. We think it's a huge step forward for Mount Shasta City, and we applaud their cooperation with this work. We also have a petition on our website that you can sign. It's asking our local stores to reduce the items packaged in plastic, because a lot of times when you go into the stores, it doesn't seem like you have much of a choice but to buy things in plastic. So, we'll give our website later on, but signing that petition would help us as well.
Well, actually, we have about a minute and a half here. Where do people get more information on that petition? Where do they get information on water? Where do they get information on the Winnemem Wintu and what they're doing up there as well?
Right. So they can go to our website at cawater.net. And if they want to look us up on Facebook, it's facebook.com/mtshastawater/. And the Winnemem Wintu Tribe, I did not pull that website up, but if you put it in, it's Winnemem Wintu, Wintu Tribe. And their website will pop right up for you.
And we'll make sure to link to all of those as well in our social media accounts as postings, as well as the blog and the information on our SoundCloud. Stiv, where do people get more information about your nonprofit organization, this film that you just released, and more resources that you think are viable to share?
Yeah, I think for the movie, if you want to see it, go to storyofplastic.org. You can organize a community screening for free. You get a download link, which is great. For Peak Plastic Foundation, follow us on Instagram at Peak Plastic. And our website, soon to be launched, is peakplasticfdn.org.
Thank you to you both for being on the show today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you to our guest today, Stiv Wilson, co-director of Peak Plastic Foundation and creator and producer of the film The Story of Plastic, and Raven Stevens, board member of Water. We advocate thorough environmental review. Thank you to our listeners for joining us, and special thank you to The Story of Stuff. This has been Part 5, The Bottle Scam, Land, Water, and Indigenous Rights of our 7-part series on the plastic plague. We look forward to bringing you, our listeners, this series and hearing what you think. Let's start a dialogue. Visit us on social media at EcoJustice Radio, SoCal350, and Adventures in Waste. If you like what you heard and you want others to be informed, subscribe to our podcast and share the episodes. You have been listening to EcoJustice Radio, recorded at KPFK Los Angeles, a project of SoCal 350. The show can be found on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and at ecojusticeradio.org. Created by Mark and JP Morris, executive producer Jack Eit, Plastic Plague series producer Georgia Tinoli, engineer Blake Lampkin, interview hosted by Jessica Aldridge from Adventures in Waste, and original music by Javier Cadre. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.